On this episode of Still Loading, Patrick Hickey Jr. Hey everyone, this is Josh, and welcome to this new episode of Still Loading. This week's episode, I am very happy to have the guest on. I have the author of a book series called The Minds Behind the Games, and now they're not all just called that. There's the minds behind the adventure games, mind behind the sports games, so on and so forth. Only two are out right now, but there is a lot more in the work. His name is Patrick Hickey Jr., and I'm so excited that he joined me for this episode. I can't wait for you to hear it, so I guess let's just dive into the interview. So for this week on Still Loading, I have the honor and privilege of interviewing an author, a journalist, I'm looking at your resume now, and there's quite a lot on it. but I'm a voice actor, as well as the founder of ReviewFix.com, Patrick Hickey. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, man. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thank you for coming onto the podcast. To kind of dive right into this, the reason we even got in contact with each other is because you are the author of a series of books called The Minds Behind the Games. I'm assuming the first one was just The Minds Behind the Games, and then you branched out from there, and then you went into The Minds Behind Adventure Games and The Minds Behind Sports Games, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. What happened was, The Minds Behind the Games was my first book, and that's kind of like why it's a smorgasbord, why there's sports games, adventure games, RPGs, fighters, and stuff like that. Because I didn't know how the retro gaming community, how the video game community would take it, so I figured if I was just going to do one book, I was just going to try and get as many cool games in there as possible. And the reaction was super solid, and I started working on a sequel pretty much right after the book came out. I knew that, this was going to be something that I could continue to do. And then I pitched my publisher with the thought of a sequel, and they said no. And I was kind of shocked. And they were like, no, stupid. Don't do a sequel like the first one. Now you can do The Minds Behind the Adventure Games, The Minds Behind the Sports Games, The Minds Behind the... Because at that point, I already had, 25 chapters written for the sequel. And they were like, yeah, You've got three potentially great books right here. You have the beginnings of three great books, and you don't even know it. And I'm like, no, I just want to do a sequel. And they're like, no, this is better. And then my wife is always the voice of reason. And she was just like, that sounds like a better idea, than you just going out and getting, 35 random games again. Now the first book was just kind of the test of waters. Now you have an audience. Now you have some cohesion. Now you can start to put it all together. So I was like, all right, let's do this. So then I signed the contract for The Minds Behind the Adventure Games, The Minds Behind the Sports Games, and The Minds Behind the Shooter Games. And those are all finished now. And Adventure came out in December of 2019. Sports is coming out in June or July, and then Shooter should be out either December or January, and they've just been great experiences, and that led the door to The Minds Behind the Sega Genesis games, which I'm working on right now. So it's not even genre specific now. Now I could do consoles, I could do decades if I wanted to. There's nothing standing in my way of continuing to do these books for as long as I wanted to. So my publisher was absolutely positively spot on. They were the smart ones in this situation.
That's really cool. This type of stuff really speaks to me in a way. This the type of books that you're writing, because I'm a huge fan of video game history. And for listeners of the podcast, I have done short episodes about I've only actually done a handful of them because I don't really have the time, unfortunately, to write out full scripts and whatnot. But sure. I've done episodes on the history of Gunpei Yokoi and other like game industry icons and stuff like that. Yeah. So your book series is right up my alley. And just like I was telling you before we started recording, I did get to finish the book, but just some of the highlights for me was the Night Trap chapter. That is a tongue twister.
Yeah.
In that chapter specifically, it blew my mind that the one creator, I can't remember which one, because you interviewed like three people for that, I believe, at least two.
Yeah,
but his girlfriend left him because of the controversy that game started, which I had no idea until I read
Rob Phillip,
your book there.
Who did, he did Space Invaders on Atari 8-bit. He did Missile Command on Atari 2600, which is one of the greatest games like of that console. I actually interviewed him about Missile Command for the Minds Behind the Shooter games. He's one of the greatest game developers like of his time, and he's known for like one of the best games of all time in Missile Command, one of the most controversial games of all time in Night Trap, and one of the cutest games of all time, like the kind of like the founding father to the whole virtual pet like Nintendogs era, you know, in Cats and Dogs, Rob Phillip. So like, I mean, he's an amazing guy, and yeah, if you want to be a video game developer, he's like a guy to speak to. He's been through everything because of his craft, you know, because of like his work, you know.
It's just like this type of stuff I'm fascinated by. So what I wanted to ask you next is how you kind of got into gaming in general. I want to kind of start with like, I mean, we're going to go back a little bit, but like, what was your first video game console or video game? Like what got you into to gaming in general before journalism, before your professional career? What sparked that interest in games?
Well, my dad was born in 1961. So figure like 1977, 1978, the Atari 2600, Pong, all of those games. So my dad was a teenager when video games became a thing, you know?
Okay.
So because of that, when I was a kid, we always had a video game system in the house. Like that, we were never rich. We were actually like kind of poor, but we always had a video game console because like to my dad, that represented like, you know, status in a way. It was like, yeah, like I'm a blue collar dude, but I got Contra in my house, you know, like I play Ice Hockey on NES and I play Tecmo Bowl and stuff. So like as a kid, the NES was in the house. That was the first system that I ever was exposed to. And, games like Contra, RBI Baseball, obviously Mario Brothers, Tecmo Bowl, like a lot of sports games, but a lot of RPGs too, you know, Zelda, played a lot of light gun games, Operation Wolf and, Hogan's Alley. And then we got the Genesis and the Super Nintendo. And then, things really changed when the PlayStation came, because that was kind of like my first console that was solely mine. The house, like kind of my dad now at this point was like in his mid to late 30s and didn't play games as much anymore. So it was just like the PlayStation was like my dedicated game console. And I kind of picked the games that were bought for that console. So that's when I started to kind of like develop my own real likes and dislikes. And that's when, you know, I started working too as a teenager, so I would buy my own games. So that's kind of like what fueled now this over 30 consoles, over 3,000 game collection that I have now. So yeah,
I can relate to that a lot. My dad is a bit older than your dad. I would think, actually they might be close to the same age. Because my dad was in his 30s when he had me, or my mom had me. And I was born in 89, so I think I'm a little bit younger than you. But he didn't grow up with really games at all. At least if he did, he doesn't talk about them at all. So,
yeah.
But he got my brother and I an N64, and then that's for me where my love of games started. And like you were saying, once you became a teenager, you started getting jobs. And I remember buying a PS1 with my own money from the jobs that I would work around.
Great feeling, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
This is all mine.
And you have a 3,000 game collection. And that was the other thing I was going to say. I'm a collector as well. I don't have nearly as big of a collection as you do. I think I just broke 1,000 console games late last year. So, like, I have a... I'm actually running out of space at the moment. I don't have the biggest room for it. But I got you. What got you into collecting then?
Just the fact that I feel like every time I go to buy a game, there's something going on in my life, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. It's just like I feel like every time I buy a game, it's like a reflection of that day, of how I feel, you know? So it's like it's kind of crazy. It's like I could just pick out a game from my collection and be like, and I'll remember like the day that I bought it, what was going on, and stuff like that. So I mean, they're like kind of like timepieces to me, but then also too. Because I write about games, I get a lot of games to review for free that, like, as a game journalist, you never sell the stuff that's given to you. That's like code of ethics. Like, any game developer, any game reviewer that sells their games that they get from publishers is like a piece of crap. That's something that, like, you really don't do. So I have hundreds of games that I've gotten, and probably thousands of games that I've gotten over the last, like, 15 years digitally. From developers that I won't get rid of. And then I just love to have a lot of this stuff. Like, I mean, I have a RG350, which is it's like a mobile emulator, and I basically have like every game that you could think of from like the Atari 2600 to the PlayStation 1 on that device. So I don't have to buy a game physically. But I still do anyway because I love to like pick out a game and go, oh, you know who produced this? The same guy that did this and the same guy that did that. So, you know, it's like I look at games almost the same way that like some people look at music, you know? So, because I do think it's art and I think it should be protected. And I don't think a lot of people think that way. I think a lot of collectors like to buy stuff because it's rare or it's expensive. And I know a lot of collectors that are like that. That they spend, you know, $200 on, you know, Samson, and they don't know the story behind it, and they don't know why it costs that much money. And to me,
Oh my God, if they spend 200 on Samson, they gotta steal.
I
Little
know, but
Samson, what,
like,
is like 800 or 900 now?
yeah, you know, but
It's wild.
or they don't even know that it's like, you know, repro copy. Like they'll just buy a copy and just be like, oh yeah, I got Samson. And then you look at the back and you're like, oh no, that's a repro copy. And they're like, how do you know? And da 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 da. And it's just like. They do it to get likes on Instagram, and it's like I buy games one to play, and then two because of the fact that they're to me they're pieces of art. So
That
yeah.
and that actually kind of leads me into one of my other questions for you was just kind of the nebulous topic of video game history, which is also one of the big thing that your book is about, is interviewing developers about the history of these iconic or these cult classic games. And that's literally the same reason I collect, is because I love the history behind it. I purposely collect things that might not be the most valuable. Don't get me wrong, if I got my hand on like a copy of Nintendo World Championships, I would lose my collective shit.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not also going to take out a bank loan in order to find some guy willing to sell it.
Absolutely.
I will, if I luck into that, that would be the next to getting married, the luckiest day of my life.
Yeah.
But like, for example, I have a Sega Pico, and that's not a valuable thing, but the idea that there was a touch screen video game console, well, touch-ish screen video game console in the early to mid 90s is one of the craziest ideas I think I've
Absolutely.
ever heard. And it's fascinating to me. So my question to you is, after kind of all that little build up there, what got you into video game history first? How did like what sparked your interest in it?
Well, I think what sparked my interest in it was that there's so, I mean, I hate to say it like this, but there's so many shitty like video game books out there. Like there's so many video game books out there that are like, oh, these are the 100 greatest games of all time. And it's like,
And that's so subjective.
yeah, like says who? You know? And as a journalist, I'm used to writing a story and trying to keep myself out of it as much as possible because no one cares about my opinion, you know? So I remember my wife was like 5 months pregnant, and I was just sitting in my man cave. I just had like a really crappy conversation with my boss. I'm a college professor, I'm a full-time college professor, and having a conversation with him about like my future. And I'm full time, I have tenure, the whole nine yards, like nothing to worry about, you know? And I was just like, let's do this. And he's just like, no. And I'm like, why? And he's like, oh, you know, basically the short answer was because that requires work. And I already have tenure, so why would I want to do any work? And he has tenure, so why the hell does he want to? Why the hell would he want to do any work? Let's just sit on our asses until we have to retire, kind of thing, you know?
Okay.
And that's not me. That's never been me. That will never be me. So I was just like, I told him, I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna write a book. And then he was basically like, you know what? Go write a book, kid. You know? And yeah. I was like, 33 at the time, and I'll never forget, I came into the room that I'm in right now, and I was just sitting around, and I'm just like, what am I gonna do? Like, what's, I want to write a book, what am I gonna write a book at? And I'm just sitting around all these video games, books, comic books, all this cool stuff, and I just start pulling games out, games like Toe Jam and Earl, and King's Bounty, and Wonder Boy and Monster World, and NBA Jam, and I'm like, nobody knows, like, the stories behind these games, who created them, why they were created, all of that stuff. I'm like, that would be a cool story. Those would be cool stories to tell. That would be different than, you know, the other video game books that are out there. And it's like nothing against a lot of them, because there are some out there that are like short review styles, like Brett Weiss's are awesome. That's the reason why I wanted him to write the foreword to the first book, because he's great at what he does, you know? But there are a lot of really, really bad ones out there. So I'm just like, I didn't want to do a video game book like that. And I didn't want to write a history book. Like, Leonard Herman's Phoenix is an amazing, like, history book on the video game industry. And I didn't want to do that either.
Okay.
So I love interviewing people. That's like my thing. And even though I'm talking now, I'm a pretty good listener too. So I like to listen to people tell stories. So I was like, what if I combine the two? What if I write like books that would allow these developers to tell their stories for the first time? It's like, if you go to somebody that loves music and you're like, who sings Thriller? They go, Michael Jackson. Or if they're really cool, they say Fall Out Boy, you know? And then if you ask somebody that likes literature, if you ask them who wrote Romeo and Juliet, they say Shakespeare right away.
Yeah.
But if you ask some gamer, like, it could be a hardcore gamer, it could be a casual gamer, it doesn't matter. If you ask him or her or they, whatever your, you know, preference is, who created Grand Theft Auto, what's their answer going to be? Rockstar.
It's true.
And,
I mean, I would say the only difference with games is that since it's such a large team that works on them, it's a little bit harder to pin it to one specific voice versus music and books. It's very easy to pin to one voice. Movies, I would say, suffers the same. There's a reason why people cling to directors and actors is because they're the noticeable, they're the upfront faces in the industry. So, but with all that said, that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be anything for gaming enthusiasts or gamers or whatever, anyone who has any kind of interest in video games. There should be something out there for you to like dive into. And there's a handful of like rock star names. I mean, you have Shigeru Miyamoto, of course, like the most famous one. But outside of that, if you ask other people, they're not going to know who like Ron Gilbert is. They're not going to know any of those other, I mean, and that's just, I mean, I heard of Ron Gilbert before I read your book, but like, even so, there's a, like a bunch of these, like Michael Mendelheim from Mutant Football League. The one that actually was really cool to me, Sarah Jane Avery in Fighting Force, because I'd never heard of that game before I read your book. Yeah. I really enjoyed that. And just, I mean, and I've heard of David Crane. I've heard of Will Wright because for The Sims. So like, there's a, you know, there are some that just kind of stick out, but that's so few and far between. That's like, if you look at all of Hollywood, how many directors can you name? And then you look at all of the video game industry, how many major players can you really name? And it's probably less than 10.
And it's crazy to the average person. The video game industry makes more money than Hollywood, you know, like video games are the highest grossing form of pop culture in the entire world. And we know so little about the people that created these games, and not to throw you know, gamers over the cliff and stuff like that. But it's like, I understand now why somebody goes, oh, who's the lead director of Red Dead Redemption 2? You may not know, because again, that team has 200 people.
But, exactly.
But like River Raid on the Atari 2600, like 3 people worked on that game. You know, if you played that game and you love that game, you should know, you know, who created it, you know, like Keystone Capers, you know, like you should know, like if you're a gamer and you play during those days and you really think you know a lot about games, you should. But a lot of people don't, you know, so that's one of the reasons
And I would even argue a lot of it isn't 100% that person's fault, because they didn't have credits on games for the longest time. Well, the first credit was an Easter egg, right?
You got it. Yep. It was Warren Robinette on Adventure. And see, that's the reason why Activision was even founded, because a lot of the, pretty much the entire like founding fathers of Activision were former Atari employees that fought to get their names put on cartridges, you know, because the companies didn't want to give these guys credit because they were scared that another company was going to come and poach them, which actively happened a lot. It's one of the reasons why, like, now I'm writing the Minds Behind the Sega Genesis games, and some of these developers, like, they don't have LinkedIn pages, and it'll be like, you know, Matsusura V. Who the hell is that? You know, like, they named themselves that so nobody would be able to find out who they are, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's pretty wild, like, trying to, like, find some of these people that created some of these games, because it was just, it was so different now. I couldn't imagine what it would be like to write an article and not put my name on it, you know, and not for like the entire world not to know that I did that, you know, but that's exactly what these developers did back then. So,
and it's just getting to, I wonder if it's more of a product now of like, or it's, I wonder if it's just a natural evolution, though, because if you think about it, film had a long, you know, learning curve. I mean, they start, what, the first earliest films are in like the early 1900s, 1920s. Yeah. Now, to be fair, I've never watched a whole lot of them, so I don't know how often that people are credited on those old ones. But like with video games are such a relatively new medium by comparison, that it's just now that people outside of those rock star names, you know, your Hideo Kojimas, your Shigeru Miyamoto's, people outside of that are starting to get noticed. Like the dudes from Naughty Dog, Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley, Amy Hennig, also from Naughty Dog, Ted Price from Insomniac Games. Like you get, you start learning bit by bit because they're becoming more present in the, and mainly because of the internet, which is an a great thing, but like they're making themselves known throughout all this, which is really Corey Balrog for God of War, stuff like that. Like you're getting to know these directors and game designers' names bit by bit. It's just, it's a slow and steady process because the industry is still pretty young.
Absolutely. I mean, I get into this problem with a lot of my coworkers because, you know, I'm a college professor, and they're just like, why would you write about video games? Like, it's just like it's kid stuff. And I look at them almost like cross-eyed, because these are the same people that wrote their master's thesis on, like, you know, the importance of Italian cinema or something like that. And what happened was their advisors, their proteges and stuff said, why are you writing about cinema? Nobody cares, blah, blah, blah. And now there's textbooks on a lot of this stuff, and you can take all different sorts of, you know, cinema studies courses. And it's like, I tell them all the time, like, you guys aren't seeing the bigger picture, because I know in 20, 30 years from now, sadly, when a lot of the people that I've interviewed begin to, you know, get old and pass away, that these stories are going to be even more important. So you're absolutely right. It's, the industry is definitely like growing into itself. And, a lot of the things that happened in the late 70s, early 80s with people not getting the proper credit and stuff, that's going to change. But it doesn't change the fact that these people had a huge impact on the games of today. And many people don't know. Many people think, you know, that God of War is just God of War. It wasn't spawned by any other, you know, game. And that's nonsense, you know, or, you know, The Sims is the first, you know, simulation game, and, you know, the first God-style game. And I'll go, did you ever play Populous before? You know, like, there's tons and tons of inspirations and things like that. I was having a conversation with a writer on my site today, and he was playing an indie game, and he was like, oh, this reminds me of Asteroids. And I was just like, well, any game that has a spaceship where you're like hitting things in space should remind you of asteroids, because that was one of the first, you know. I was like, this is actually a lot more like Super Fantasy Zone. And he's like, oh, I never played Super Fantasy Zone. So I'm like, okay, stop writing the review. You know, go on your emulator and download Super Fantasy Zone. I'm like, even like the boss in this game looks like the boss from Fantasy Zone. And he's like, really? Really? And he started playing and he was like, yeah, you were right. And then he started looking at interviews that the developer had done, and he found out that Fantasy Zone was like one of the inspirations for the game. And I'm like, see? Mm-hmm. So it's just like there's this huge problem with a lot of game critics out there where they think they know a lot more than they do. And that's the thing, man. When I first started writing these books, I thought I knew a ton about the video game industry. And now I'm finishing up book five, and I've realized how little I know. And I know a lot more than I knew, you know, say 2-3 years ago. And yeah. It's still like a drop in the barrel. Like, I have people that I call friends now in the video game industry, because, you know, I'm doing voiceover in games and I'm writing stories for games and stuff like that now. And they tell me things all the time, and I'm just like, wow. Like, it just changes the way that you think about the medium and how important it is, and the lives that are affected by these creations. So it's like, it's so much bigger and grander, and the stakes are super high. The crunch is immense. Like, these guys and girls and everybody, they put so much into these creations, and a lot of people just, they don't get it. They don't know. And I feel like that's been my biggest inspiration, to try and tell the stories of these people, so people understand mm-hmm. that it's not just fun in games.
And I mean, there's even like other journalists, like the, I don't know, you might have seen in the news today, but Jason Schreier over Kotaku, he's leaving Kotaku.
At the time of this recording. He's been writing some articles for the Times lately too. So,
but he's written so many. He's written a bunch of articles about the crunch that game developers go through.
Yeah, and but like, see, the biggest problem with Jason Schreier's work is, like, Jason Schreier does something that, like, any, like, solid journalist would try and do as little as possible. And Jason Schreier has a ton of anonymous sources in his articles. Like, yeah, he gets people... the thing is, it's like, I understand why these people are anonymous, you know? But at the same time, too, if you don't put a name to something, then it stays mystified. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. a better reporter would go out and get the names of the people. And, like, the reason why he was able for so long to get away with using so many anonymous sources is because he was an editor over there. So, like, no one was fact-checking him. And I believe all of his work is absolutely credible. I believe he's telling the truth. But he's hurting mm-hmm. the legacy of his work. Like, I'm finishing my fifth book. I've interviewed like over 200 game developers. All of them are on the record. All of them are saying things that could get them in a lot of trouble. They're saying things that some people might not want to hear, you know, but they're saying it. They're putting their name on the dotted line, and they're saying, I said this. That's different than writing, oh, you know, Blizzard sucks and there's a ton of crunch. And what's going to happen is people are going to read the headline, and the article is going to get millions of page views. And that's what Kotaku and Polygon and all these places want. But how is that changing history if there's no name to it, you know?
So, you're fine. Other than the name of the developer, but that you make a fair point with that.
You know, and he does, like I said, he does great work, but at the end of the day, like, he's hurting his legacy by not, like, he's basically hitting a triple and standing on third base when he could try and go and take out the catcher at home. That's kind of, okay. like, what I think of his work. Like, it's so close to being so amazing, but it's just like, he just stops. So now he'll work for the Times, and he'll make a six-figure salary, and his books will sell more and stuff like that, but at the end of the day... like, he's still hitting a stand-up triple, and he's still breathing fine, and he can totally go and, again, take out the catcher and, like, hit a home run and do, like, journalism and do video game history a great service, instead of just, like, right now he's just kind of lining his own pockets, because most people are too stupid to understand, like, how close he is to being, like, so amazing. Just my thought.
Okay. I don't know where to go from that. let me see what I got here. All right, so let's kind of shift and talk about this then. So, what got you into, well, I actually answered this, never mind. So what are some of your favorite interviews from the books you've done, or in your career in general, maybe even outside of the books? What are some of your favorite game developers that you've been able to interview?
So I've spoken to Neil Druckmann before. That was a lot of fun. I've spoken to, like I said, Rob Fulop for Night Trap, John Tobias for Mortal Kombat, Rob Fulop for Night Trap. I've spoken to, like, pretty much all of the founding fathers of Electronic Arts, for, like, John Madden Football, PGA Tour, Mutant League, NHL, Earl Weaver Baseball, like, all of the games that, like, that EA needed to, like, build their foundation, I've interviewed those developers. So, like, those are some of my favorite interviews that I've done. Like, I'll never forget, like, I was sitting in a hotel lobby with Michael Brook, who was the assistant producer on the original Madden and Earl Weaver and NHL Hockey, NHL PA 93, NHL 94. And we were just talking about how they decided to come up with this idea to release a sports game every year, because up until that point, it was kind of considered like lunacy, you know?
Yeah.
Earl Weaver had downloadable updates like in 1988, 1989. Like, this is
what?
Yeah. You know, and everyone thought that they were crazy for doing that. How much do you charge? Do you charge, like, you know, the price of a full game? And these were the guys that, like, made they formulated the industry that we know today. They were so freaking smart, you know, they were so ahead of the curve. And to be able to talk to them, those are probably some of the greatest moments of my, you know, journalistic career.
And that's just wild for me to think, because, like, there is a perception among the gaming community that, like, this whole idea of just, like, the, you know, it's Madden or, like, sports games being an annual thing, and how the rosters just get updated, and why don't they just, like they're charging you to add new things to it, like microtransactions, blah, 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 all that crap. And I understand it's different from when they envisioned it back then, but it's crazy to think back in 1989 they had the idea of downloadable updates.
Yeah.
Like, that, yeah. Even, like, that was part of the idea of the model.
Earl Weaver Baseball, you could create your own stadiums. You could create your own players. You could even, they had a update to the game where you could get the computer to announce your created player when they went up to the plate. They had instant replay in the game already, and the game never made it to Sega. It was only on the PC. But, like, we're talking, like, without Earl Weaver Baseball, you never have, like, later, like, The Show and, you know, MLB 2K and MLB 2000 from Sony and stuff. So, like, some of the work that these guys did was so far ahead of, like, everything everyone else was doing at the time. So, like I said, to be able to interview these guys, I mean, that was some of the coolest moments of my life. And the thing is, too, what a lot of people don't know is a lot of those guys from EA Sports, they ended up leaving at one point.
Yeah.
And Don Traeger is a guy. He was basically the guy that wanted to create EA Sports. So he ended up leaving EA, and he got a job as a producer for a company called BMG. Okay. And they produced a couple of games like Courier Crisis and Spider. But BMG eventually went out of business and folded and became Rockstar. And one of the first games that Rockstar Games ever published, which was originally a BMG game that was in development for a super long time, and that BMG picked up because Don Traeger thought that it had promise, was Grand Theft Auto, you know?
Okay.
So it's kind of like you've got definitely like that Kevin Bacon game thing going on, where like
the seven these degrees guys, of separation or whatever.
Yeah. Listen, EA did so many things great for the video game industry. So like you have people talking about, especially like after Star Wars came out, about, you know, all the microtransactions are killing it. The industry sucks now. Like, they're one of the reasons, blah, blah, blah. Man, like, the stuff that EA Sports and EA in general did for this industry in the late 80s and early 90s, it's the reason why many people still play video games today. So,
100%. I, that's like one of the, like, there's a handful of, like, This doesn't. I was about to say there's a handful of fun facts that like people who are into video game history like to drop on casual gamers to be like, "Did you know?" I was going to say that was one of them, but that would be like a long one. My go-to is always like, "Did you know Nintendo helped create the PlayStation or something like that?" Like a really like a lot of people are into game history.
Well, I mean, know, even like too, that, like with Atari, you know, Atari was supposed to be the publisher of the original Nintendo Entertainment System. Yeah. You know, and so many people don't know that either. Yeah. So
But like it's just funny to see what EA has become, because I understand the criticisms of it, and I understand where like I do think a good chunk of them are valid, but it is like you always have to think back of like what they did, because like you were saying beforehand, before EA came into existence, developers were never credited for their work. It's just it's wild that it's so crazy to think that you could spend literally hours and months and weeks and years working on something, only to not even have your name appear on it.
Yeah.
Like, that's just crazy.
Yeah.
In terms of the interviews, like how did you go about choosing who to interview? Was it more of a case of availability, or did you have like personal preferences? Like, I'm going for these guys. These guys or girls, like I have to get them. Or was it more just like, you just kind of cast a wide net and see who could see what you were able to drag in?
Well, the first book, to be honest, the first book, I didn't know. Like, I remember my publisher was telling me they wanted the book to be at least 75,000 words. So I was looking at like the length of each chapter of the book being around like 2,500 words. And I'm like, shit, that means I need like at least 25 games. Wow. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there was like a moment where I was just like, am I going to get like, and I knew that I was going to be able to get 25 developers, but I was like, was I going to be able to get 25 like good stories? Like, cause I mean, there have been developers that like, I've spoken to them and I'm like, yeah, there's really not that much of a story here. You know, there's not like something that like you could take away. So I ended up with 36 chapters in the first book. I ended up casting a super wide net, and it worked out great because some of the people that didn't get back to me for the first book ended up getting back to me for the second, third, and fourth book. So that worked out good. It ended up being, I didn't know if I told you in the beginning, I didn't know if I was going to be able to do a second book. You know, I didn't know like how the response was going to be. I didn't know if like I was going to have time. My wife had just had our first child. So I didn't know if I was going to have the time. I didn't know, you know, there were so many unknowns at the time. So I was just like, if I'm only going to be able to do one book, I'm going to try and get as many of like the games that I grew up with playing. And then also games that I felt like had importance. Like, again, like the story of Night Trap, I feel like is absolutely super important to like, I feel like my books have an audience of casual gamers that want to know more, hardcore gamers that want to know more too, and then aspiring game developers. So like, I want the average person to go in finding out more. I want the hardcore gamer to come in having even a greater appreciation for the game after reading the chapter. And then I want a young developer to look at like all of the work that went into the game and say, holy shit, if this is what I want to do with my life, then I have to really like step up and I can learn from the mistakes and successes of these people. So
that's
the way I try and structure each chapter in a way. So if a chapter doesn't have something like that in it, then I won't use it for the book. So reaching out to the developer is the first thing, getting them to talk is the next, and then seeing if it can fall into any of those categories so it could be useful for somebody. That's the most important part. So that's emails, that's phone calls, that's Skype calls, that's face-to-face, that's like smoke signals, like anything that I could do to get in contact with them, like I'm willing to do. I mean, I've done interviews at like 2 o'clock in the morning from like Australia, like from Brooklyn, New York to Australia in my kitchen, just because I didn't want to wake up anybody in my family, you know. I'll do like whatever I need to do in order to get these developers to tell their story. So, and I feel like it's at the point now where I was talking to a developer actually like 5 minutes before the podcast, and she was a part of a game that has like a pretty crazy backstory to it that like nobody knows, and it's a super like tender like subject. There's a lot of like moving parts and stuff, and I have like four people from the dev team that I spoke to, and she's like, go do your magic, you know? So to be like, to have a developer have that much trust in you, I mean, it says something. And these people are very guarded. They care a lot about their creation. So to consider like where I started on this, like in October of 2016 to where I am now, I mean,
yeah,
it says a lot. So.
Oh, and I would think that I would, I mean, if this is the case, let me know. I feel like it would be like, it's probably starting to get easier to get interviews because at least from what I've read in the first book, you're not critical of the games. You don't, and that not, I don't mean that in a bad way, like you're not looking at the good or bad things, but you're trying to paint each of these stories in a positive light because these developers went through something in order to bring us this entertainment. So you want to make sure that they're not being besmirched, is a weird word to use, but essentially that's what it is, you know, like absolutely. You're not trying to insult anybody. So when you go back and you see that, and you see, they see that they, you know, they see your other books and they can take a look at like what your body of work has been so far. And they realize you're not out to make them look like the bad guy. You're not out to dick them over in any way. You're just trying to understand the story. You're just trying to know the story. And if they, at that point, like they're telling you what they, you know, what they feel comfortable telling you. So if they are comfortable with giving you that kind of information, I would almost say that's more credit to you in a sense that they see your body of work. Like he's not going to like, he's going to do this with justice, and it's not going to be something where it's going to just kind of dick us over. It's going to be an honest, like it's going to be an honest retelling of what happened.
It's like, I'll give you a perfect example, like a microcosm. I was supposed to be on a podcast like 3 weeks ago, and the guy messaged me on Instagram, and he was like, do you want to be on my show? And, and I said, I listened to one of his shows, and I was like, sure. And then I'm just watching his feed, and then he reviewed like three games on his feed, and he was just trashing them. And I'm just like, yeah, I message him. I'm like, I don't want to be on your show. And he's like, why? And I'm like, because I'm like, all you do is like, you review games. I was like, which is fine. I'm like, but you don't talk about like everything. You just say, oh, this game sucks. Stay away from it. Blah, 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 blah. I'm like, you sound like a consumer guide. I'm like, you're not a journalist. You're supposed to present like all the sides of the story and stuff. And, I think, like I said, there's so many game books out there that are like, oh, the 100 greatest, the 100 worst, the 100 strangest, you know, video games of all time. And I just felt like,
yeah,
I felt like the video game industry deserved more. And I feel like if they understand that I'm not out to like review their game, if they ask me, it's happened before. I've had developers go, okay, like, why do you want my game in there? Like, it's not that good of a game.
Yeah.
And I'll tell them, like, I'll give you an example. There's a game that's going to be in the Sega Genesis book, ESPN okay. National Hockey Night on the Sega Genesis. And I don't think it's a bad hockey game, but it's definitely not. It's not like in the EA Sports category.
Yeah, you know? It's not the upper echelon, but it's solid. No.
Yeah, it's a little bit better than mediocre. It's got different camera views, which was really cool for the time. It's got the ESPN license and stuff like that. It's got some stuff going for it, but it's not up to par. But the reason why I want it in is because Craig Broadbooks, the guy that worked on that game, he later became the guy that made all the NHL Face-Off games for the PlayStation. Okay. So that was like that. The NHL Face-Off series was the shit for PlayStation 1. Like those were the hockey games. They were better than the NHL games. So that's like one of the first games he ever worked on. So I told him, I'm like, I want to get inside the mind of the guy that worked on that and how that played a role in all of those great million seller, you know, hockey games on the PlayStation. He goes, ah, all right, I gotcha. And I'm like, that's why I want people to know. So, and again, too, we don't think of video games like that. Like if you look at a game, I don't know, if you look at a game like Burnout, for example, you look at it very like singularly. It's just a racing game mm-hmm. with like crash. You know, but like I look at it and go, I wonder what games like influence this. And then I think maybe like Destruction Derby, Chase HQ, like there's a bunch of racing games out there that have like destructible elements to them, you know? So that's kind of how yeah. I want gamers to get like super geeky when they read this stuff. I want them to look at games in a different sense. I want them to go, oh shit, the guy that created Yokai, he worked on Dark Cloud 2 and Rogue Galaxy. Yeah, bro, he did. Absolutely. You know, like, that's how I want people to get kind of like that. So that's why I think developers like latch onto me, because they know that I know a lot of like the geeky stuff, and that I want to tell those type of stories, and no one ever asks them those questions. So when I kind of come along, I give them this outlet to do that, and they have fun. So
I also like that there's not a lot of books out there interviewing game developers in general. So like you're saying, there's a lot of video game books out there, but most of them are just kind of, you know, top 100 this, top 50 mm-hmm. that, you know, just yeah. stuff like that. I look for books in video game books that are coming from a specific vantage point. So for example, have you ever heard of a website called Legends of Localization?
No, I haven't. Now I have to check it out.
So awesome. What they do, I don't know this guy at all. His name's Clyde Mandolin. I heard him on another video game podcast called Retronauts, and what they do, or what him and his wife Heidi do, is that they're localizers. And so what he did is he went back to the original Legend of Zelda, and he broke down every single translation difference. Like, he looks at the original Japanese text, and then he looks at the English translation, the English localization, and he's like, all right, this is kind of how we think it would, like, this is what we think the thought process would have been because of A, B, and C. And they do that for, they've done books, and there's a Legend of Zelda one, and there's also an Earthbound one, which I don't have the Earthbound one yet, but their whole website is dedicated to stuff like that. They have little tiny, like, articles where he'll look at one game's original, like, the original Japanese language of it, and then he'll look at the localization, and he'll break it down. To me, that's super fascinating, because it's not just a top 10 or whatever. It's actually like, well, here's, you know, the little literal regional differences between what Japan had and what the U.S. had.
Absolutely. Oh, excuse me. Like, I love that.
And I even have a book called I Am Error, which I have not read all the way through yet, because it's a very like technical thing, but it's a technical breakdown of the NES, like down to like how the video would go from the picture processing unit to the graphics processing unit, blah, 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 like the literal technical breakdown. And they go through it and explain how, like, it informed game design on the NES and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And once again, that's super fascinating to me. Like, hearing someone's, like you said, opinion of their top 50 of all time games, that's fine for a podcast, but then that's not like actual journalism. That's entertainment.
Yeah. And then the problem is, like, somebody will go and write a book like that, and then people will read it, and then they'll cite that information as fact, you know? And that's, like, that's where you have huge problems. Like, I'll give you another, like, quick example, like, stuff, like, that pisses me off when people do that. Doing research for The Minds Behind the Sports Games, I was looking up stuff from Earl Weaver Baseball, and I was playing it on a DOS box and trying to, like, connect with it as much as possible. I interviewed the developer. We had this super long interview. Like, he gave me, like, 6,000 words of, like, great quotes and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, like, amazing stuff about how, like, he got into video games because he was a ballet dancer, and he wanted to create, like, a program that would allow ballet dancers to kind of, like, create dance, like dance syncopation via the computer and stuff, like, wacky, crazy stuff that you would never expect before he got into, like, before he met Don DeGlau and they started working on, you know, the game, the baseball game. But, obviously, when you start searching for stuff, Wikipedia comes up right away. So I always read the Wikipedia entry, and one of my first questions always is, like, tell me what's wrong on the Wikipedia page, and that always gets a laugh, and I get a lot of stuff. But I remember reading the Earl Weaver entry on Wikipedia, and then I watched a video from Pat the NES Punk, Pat Contry, and this is a guy that has a huge following. You know, hundreds of thousands of people, and he's been on TV shows and stuff like that. And I watched, like, a 3-minute video that he did on Earl Weaver Baseball, and he basically read the Wikipedia entry. That was his post. It was him sitting with Ian and him just talking about, like, the game. And there was no new information, and it was basically, like, verbatim the Wikipedia page. And I'm like, what's going to happen now is some 14, 15-year-old kid that loves Pat Country and what's not to love. He's super entertaining. He's super funny. He's like, you know, he wants to be like Howard Stern of like retro gaming and stuff like that, you know. But but what did you add? What did you add to the zeitgeist? What did you add to like the discussion? You know, so when I watched that video, I was kind of like, you know what? My chapter on Earl Weaver baseball is going to be the chapter that people are going to go, wow, I knew none of this stuff. I appreciate this game so much more. And this guy that I don't know, this author that I don't know, dug so much deeper than anybody else was willing to dig. Like, that's kind of like what I'm aiming to do. And it's like, again, that video that Pat Country did, it got great traffic. I mean, I don't have a video on my YouTube page that has done anywhere near the traffic that Earl Weaver video did. But his video didn't add anything to the conversation. That's what my goal is to, like, strip away all of, like, that's the thing. We look at video games as, like, kiddie and fun and silly. But it's a huge, it's a billion-dollar industry. And there's some of the most creative people in the entire world creating video games. And those people deserve a lot more attention than what they've gotten up until this point.
And like, I at least in terms of my opinion, like, video games are kiddie and childlike, but they're also not just that. Like, it's very, mm-hmm. it's super insulting to limit it to just that. Whenever I tell people, like you were saying before, like, I agree with you. Video games are art. They are an art form. Or, I mean, on a technical level, there was a video I saw this a while ago. It was like, you can't debate that video games are an art. Like, on a technical level, on a technical definition, it is 100% mm-hmm. art. But absolutely. People usually try to debate is it high art? You know, like, you know,
oh, yeah,
are they like equivalent to a Martin Scorsese film or something mm-hmm. like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, highbrow, lowbrow. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Exactly. Is there, and don't get me wrong, there's games that are definitely like lowbrow entertainment. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
This is not a knock on it, but like the Duke Nukem series, like that's lowbrow. They're fun.
Oh, there's yeah. Leisure wrong Suit with it. Larry. And, you know, like I love those games, you know, Parappa the Rappa, but like at the end of the day, they're not having like a huge impact on, you know, society. But what's
they're not
gonna
making
happen,
a statement in a sense.
Absolutely. In 20 years from now, 25 years from now, the president of the United States, male or female, I guarantee you, is going to have played Final Fantasy VII and Super Mario, and they're going to make a reference to like one of those things one day in a speech, and people are gonna get it, you know. And it's like you nailed it mm-hmm. before. Like when you said it, I was just like so happy to be on this show. When you were just like, you know, video games are still in their infancy and people are still kind of like growing into the impact that they possibly could have, you know?
Mm-hmm. So and part of the fun of like diving back into game history is seeing like some of the most ambitious idea or some of the ideas that we consider a modern concept in game design have show up in like old stuff. The example I always give on the podcast and also whenever I'm streaming or doing something like that is Castlevania 2 Simon's Curse. Simon's mm-hmm. Curse, right? I just wanted to make sure I didn't. Yeah, Simon's Curse. That's an open world game with day and night with a day and night cycle.
Yeah.
Like that, and that's crazy to me. Like you have, I mean, granted, it is very limited and very broken in a sense, but they really push the envelope for what the NES could do, where they had this whole thing. And, you know, there's different enemies in the day versus the night and stuff like that. Like there, it's not just like an aesthetic from day to night. It's actually like a full different set of gameplay rules, which is what games do now. There's a day and night cycle and that kind of stuff. Hell, even if you want to go back even older, you have the Ultima series. What is it? Ultima 4, the Avatar or whatever. I have not played this game because they are ridiculously long. But that game had a whole morality system, like a super complex morality system mm-hmm. that we usually associate with games like Fable and then games later on with like Mass Effect and BioWare games and stuff like that. But, you know, you go back 20, 30 years prior to those games coming out and you have Ultima 4 where the whole purpose of the game was to get your like to check your morality. It's crazy to look back and see, like, I mean, that's why I like books like yours in a sense where there's stuff that I already do know, like I understand, like when you look back at old games and you can kind of analyze them from a gameplay perspective, but context is also a huge part of game history. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And getting the developers behind it is a big part of that. I don't know if you've ever followed these guys before, but do you know who Frank Cifaldi and the Video Game History Foundation is? He was not telling me, I don't know him personally, but I was listening to something he was on, and he has the court documents from the Donkey Kong case with Nintendo and Universal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or crazy. Copies of it. It's crazy, but like context is so important. So it's cool to me where you can find, whether it's books or whether it's YouTube or anything, but something that teaches you that's more than just the, I like this because of A, B, and C, or I dislike this because of A, B, and C. And it's admittedly, that's what I am, because I don't have all the resources to do something like that. Mm-hmm. I do try my best to say that when I like something, it's because of A, B, and C. And, you know, like I go into a bit more analytical sense of it, but even so, like, I'm not necessarily providing history. I'm having to look up other people's research, cite them, and then, or if I'm just reading off Wikipedia, I usually say, I'm just reading this off Wikipedia so you can go find it yourself. Like, yeah. I'm not trying to bullshit anybody and say, like, I know what I'm talking about. I looked up research.
Absolutely.
Sorry,
It's just like, at the end of the day, I just want people to realize that their opinion of the game isn't like the end all be all of like the conversation. That you can still have a great conversation, or you can still appreciate a game despite the fact that you may not like to play it. You know, one of the big conversations I have all the time is about E.T. And people all the time, oh, how could you like E.T.? It's the worst game of all time. It killed the Atari 2600. And I'm like, if you think that E.T. single-handedly killed the Atari 2600, then you're almost too stupid to live.
Because Atari killed the Atari 2600.
Yes, yes. And the thing is, it's just like, you release so many shoddy arcade ports one after another. And then you release a game like E.T. in 5 weeks that just wasn't ready yet. The average Atari 2600 game took, you know, 9 months from start to finish. Like, if you do that, it's just like, you're just setting yourself up for failure. What people were like, you know what, like, I could play this game for $1 in the arcade for an hour, and then I could come back like a week and do it again. Like, the idea of a home console wasn't where it is now. Now, can you imagine, like, what the world would be like if there were no home consoles now? You know, everyone's...
I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. Atari was super ahead of their time. Like, they were the people that, like, made the home console more than just, like, a sexy thing. They put a home console in nearly everyone's home, and then it got to the point where they just, like, kind of... they ran out of steam. And then it took Nintendo to come along. And then, I mean, Atari had a resurgence again in the late 80s when they started making the Atari Jr. and stuff like that. And there were several games on the Atari 2600 that sold incredibly well. Like, Double Dragon on Atari 2600 sold like 460,000 copies, which back in 1988 is huge. You know?
That's so crazy. I mean, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so Atari didn't necessarily, like... First off, Atari didn't really die. The video game industry was just growing, and there was like self-correcting going on, and you know, it was kind of like Pogs in a way. Mm-hmm. Pogs were hot for a while, everyone had it, and then they realized that like Pogs were fucking stupid, and then everyone stopped playing with Pogs. Or like Dungeons and Dragons, a lot of people used to play Dungeons and Dragons, a lot of people don't play Dungeons and Dragons anymore, but you still have a huge collection of people that play. And then every once in a while, something like Stranger Things comes along and makes like Dungeons and Dragons sexy again, and people will play it. So now, like, video games are now permanently, you know, enshrined in our pop culture. But back in, you know, the late 70s and stuff like that, and early 80s, that wasn't the case. So a game like E.T. and the crappy Pac-Man port and all of those games, like, when you add them all on top of each other, they put a really bad taste in people's mouth, and that's kind of like why Atari, you know, went through that self-correction. So it wasn't just one game. But again, this was just like a 3-minute conversation. The average gamer doesn't want to have a 3-minute conversation. They want it to be E.T. sucks. Okay, where are you in Red Dead 2? You know, like they want the conversation to end right there. They don't want to continue to have the conversation. So that's a hard pill to swallow sometimes.
Well, and that's the type of audience, not that what I'm trying to say is the type of audience I've been trying to build with my podcast. And I'm not even saying intentionally, I just kind of speak my mind and, you know, see where things go. But like, I would hope the people who listen to this podcast are the type of people who aren't like that, who want to really like look at games and be like, well, what is like, why does someone not like this? Like, not just like this sucks and here's why I think it, like, not just this sucks and let's move along. More perfect example. I've talked about this before, and I'm not going to go into a crazy long thing, but like, I'm not the biggest fan of Skyrim, and that's an unpopular opinion because everybody loves Skyrim. But I have specific reasons. It's not because of, you know, like I, you know, was really bad at it at one point in time or this and that, but it's more like I wasn't a fan of the controls, the graphics don't appeal to me, and I could go into more detail with that, not the time or place right now, but like it wouldn't just be like, all right, Skyrim sucks, let's move along. I wouldn't just kind of leave it out there just for people to rage at. It would just be like, if you're going to criticize something, then have it be actual criticism and not just being a dick, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes perfect sense.
And I would hope that the people that listen to my podcast, even if they disagree with my opinions on things, they look at it as more of like it's inspiring them to be critical of something, not necessarily critical of the game, but hell, even like critical of my opinion. Like, okay, I disagree with him for A, B, and C reasons, but like being more analytical in general with their thought process towards games, because a lot of people worked on these, so it's kind of insulting just to dismiss something that took months to create.
Absolutely. And like at the end of the day, like, see, with me, it's just I want to have a really good conversation. That's what I want. I want to sit down and I want to have a real conversation about a game and have you leave and go, you know what, the next time I play this game and I get to that part that I don't like, and now that I know what happened, I'm still not going to like it, but I'm going to look at it a little bit differently. Like, I'll give you an example. Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. I'm not sure if you've ever played it before, but it's based on the book. It's not based on the movie. It's not an EA Lord of the Rings game. Another company did it, and it was on PS2. And there's one part of the game when Frodo is trying to escape the Shire, but the ring rates are after him. It's like this one little part of the game is so goddamn hard. Like, I must have died 100 times trying to get past this one part. And, no exaggeration. Like, to the point where, like, I was so pissed off that I was like, I'm not going to play another game until I get past this part. Like, I'm like, I'm going, I know it's possible to beat this. I know it can happen, and I'm going to do it. And I remember asking the developer, I'm like, did something happen like with this? And he was just like, we didn't tune it. He goes, it's incredibly hard. He goes, it even takes me time to beat. And he goes, I know a lot of critics couldn't get past it. And that's one of the reasons why they rated the game, you know, so low. And I said, listen, after I got past that, I beat the rest of the game in like 5 hours. I was like, I love the game. Like, it grew on me. I like the art style. I like that Tom Bombadil was in the game. Like, it stayed close to the book. You know, it was great. There was never another game like it. And then their sequel, The Treason of Isengard, got canceled. So they never got to do another Lord of the Rings game. So, you know, I was like, I appreciate it. He just explained in the interview, like, all the things that went wrong with the game. And that, like, for him was like the hardest part, that like they couldn't tune that part of the game because they felt like if they would have been able to tune that part of the game, they would have had much different success in terms of sales and critical reception, you know? So that's what I want. I want somebody to like read that chapter and then look at the game and go, oh shit. Okay. All right. all right, it's not as bad as GameSpot said that it was, because that person probably wasn't good enough to get past that. And see, that's the thing, too. Like, what a lot of game critics don't understand is that, like, not only do you have to be a good gamer to be a critic, because you have to be able to finish the game. If you review a game and you didn't finish it, you're terrible. Like, how can you, like, you don't watch half of a movie and review it, you know? So you've got to be a solid gamer, but then at the same time, too, you've got to be able to, like you said before, look at the context and try and get inside the developer's head to kind of find out what their intentions were on this game. Like, who is their audience? It's kind of like I tell my students all the time, because I teach journalism. I've taught journalism for 14 years. I say, like, if I have to review a Justin Bieber album, I'm going to review that album differently than I'm going to review, like, a Metallica album, because they have two completely different audiences. So there may be a situation where, like, I don't like Justin Bieber, his music, but I may give the album a positive review because I know the people that the album is intended for, they'll love it.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and to kind of bring back to, like, what I was saying, like, how I'm not the biggest fan of Skyrim, I will never actually say Skyrim is a bad game, because that there's a very big difference, like you're saying, context is everything. That game may just not be for me. It just may not be my cup of tea. Mm-hmm. So when I look at it, when I look at objective criticisms that I have of it, like I said, maybe it's been fixed since the last time I played it, and maybe I'm just misremembering, but I just remember the controls weren't very good. That's the only thing objectively that I can say. Everything else, like, I don't like the art, that's more subjective. You know, if you don't like the graphics, like, I can't say the graphics are actually bad. It's just, like, I don't like how they look. And for at the time, the graphics looked like a game should for at the time. And even with the gameplay, I'm not a big fan of more like I like open world games, but I don't like it when they focus so much on exploration. I need more things to do. And Skyrim is a very explorative based game.
Oh, yeah. Once I mean, again, you could get to parts in Skyrim like 2 hours in, and some people don't find it until 40 hours in, you know, because they went right and you went left. I completely understand where you're coming from. Mm-hmm.
And so, once again, I'm never going to say Skyrim is an actual bad game, because I can criticize it, but that's just all going to be based off my opinion. So if I were to actually review that, I'd honestly probably give it a pretty high score, even though it's not something I would enjoy playing. Granted, I'm not a professional critic. Hell, even with game criticism, though, what a lot of people don't recognize, and this isn't coming from me. I'm kind of repeating a point from a podcast I listened to, which I've referenced a bunch of times on mine, called Retronauts. Mm-hmm. Once again, they don't know me, but they were a bunch of former game critics. They used to be in the games press, and they say, like, you can't take our reviews so seriously, because they are fixed to a very specific point of in time and specific to that reviewer. Because you can look back, and, like, if you look back at, like, Majora's Mask, I don't know how that did in terms of reviews, but there's games back, you know, if you go back to the 90s and 80s, there are games that reviewed super poorly, but then when you go back and look at it now, you're like, yo, this actually holds up pretty well. Like, I don't know, like, why did this get bombed so bad? And it's very important to not necessarily take, and the same goes for good reviews. Just because a game reviewed super well at the time, you look back on it years later, perfect example, and I love this series, but the Medal of Honor series. If you go back and you play the Medal of Honor series, it doesn't hold up, mainly because of the controls. That's the big thing. It's hard to modernize controls when you didn't have two joysticks. You only had a D-pad on the PS1.
Yeah.
But, like, that game doesn't hold up, and that's not necessarily the game's fault. It's just a product of its time. But that game got glowing reviews. But if someone were to review a game like that now, it wouldn't do well, because it's locked in to that very specific point in time.
It's funny, because I had the same conversation with the guy that did a... No, it's okay. I had a conversation with the guy that... Nick Cusworth. He did Croc on PS1 and Sega Saturn. And a lot of people complain about the control for Croc. And one of the reasons why it controls the way that it does is because, like, DualShock and analog controls were invented as that game was being released. So that was, like, one of the last games to ever use, like, the D-pad. But the problem is, it's a 3D platformer. So when you play a 3D platformer, you're expecting analog control. and this did not have analog control, and or it wasn't perfected at that point. So, I mean, it loses something in translation. And, you know, for him, he's just like, it's something that he would love to go back to and, like, re-release the game with better controls and stuff like that, because he felt like it's super important. And, like, that game has a crazy, crazy backstory. That's in the Minds Behind Adventure games. But, like, Croc, I mean, like, Croc should have been a Yoshi platformer on the Nintendo 64. You know, on the Super Nintendo, I mean, you know, they had, Argonaut had 3D technology down, like, pretty much before anybody. Argonaut are the people that designed the FX chip. That's Dylan Cuthbert, that's Star Fox.
Okay.
You know, so, like, those guys had a great relationship with Nintendo, and then it just, like, all kind of went out the window, and then Dylan ended up going to Sony, and he did Blasto, and... So, like, those guys, all those guys at Argonaut Software, they had a huge impact on the video game industry, and they're just some, like, little, they were just some little UK, like, outfit, and a lot of people don't know who they are. But it's just, like, again, that's the reason why I decided to write the book, because if you're a gamer and you play a lot of, like, Super Mario-type games, you need to know, like, the impact that, like, Croc and all those guys had, because they shaped, without Croc, you wouldn't have had Mario 64. And a lot of people say, oh, well, they came out at the same time, but... Croc was in development for a very long time, and Nintendo saw it before anybody else. Nintendo saw that, like, Argonaut had perfected the 3D polygonal platformer, and they were like, holy shit, we need to make a Mario game before these guys do theirs, because everyone's going to think that we bit off of them, which they did, you know? So, stuff like that.
There was that, I think I heard a story, something like that. I didn't know... if that was actually true or not. There was some developer, I don't know if it was the Croc developer, that took credit for, not took credit, but, like, say they inspired Mario 64. I don't know if it was Croc. It might have been some, yeah, like the developer of it was saying, but it wasn't, like, from the literally no research I did other than seeing it on their Twitter. I didn't know if it was verified or not. Like, it was just that developer saying, like, oh yeah, I totally inspired Mario 64, but I don't know if it had ever really truly been confirmed, or if he was just blowing smoke up people's asses or something. I don't think
like Nick would never do that. Like, and like Dylan Cuthbert would never do that either. Like, it must have been, you've probably read somebody else, but like, I mean, that's the thing too. I talk to developers all the time, and they're like, oh, like a lot of companies had weird policies. Like, I'll give you an example. Rockstar, if you didn't stay on a game until it was completed, you didn't get credit. So let's just say you were on a game day one, and let's say 2 weeks before your wife gave birth and you had to, like, leave, or you had to quit. You got in a fight because they wouldn't give you off or something like that. And you left the project, a project that you were on 98% of the time, and you did a ton of work. If you weren't on the last day when that game went gold, they didn't put your name on the credits.
Mm.
So, like, there are people in the industry that have had a huge impact that haven't gotten the credit that they deserve. That's another reason why I decided to do these books too, because there's so many stories like that. It's more than, like, people getting dumped by their boyfriend or girlfriend is crazy. People living in hotels, like, living off of, like, residuals until the game is released, that's crazy. You know, all sorts of those are all crazy stories. But then stuff like that too is just amazing too. I mean, then there's the whole, you know, women in the industry have never been treated, you know, fairly up until not so long ago. Like, I've spoken to female developers that worked in the industry in the 80s and 90s, and the stuff that they had to go through because of, like, the frat mentality that the industry was in. I'm like, that stuff really hasn't been told. I'm going to tell some of those stories in my Genesis book. But, like, there's just so many things that people need to know. Like, if you're a fan of the industry, you need to know it. If you're a lover of the industry, you definitely deserve to know it. And if you're somebody that, like, wants to get into the industry, you have to know it. And I think, like, after my first book came out, I ended up doing, like, voice acting and story editing, and I'm still working in the industry now. And I feel like if I hadn't interviewed all of these people, then I wouldn't have known what to expect. And the fact that I've done all these interviews, it gives me, like, the leg up in communication with a lot of these people, and, like, on my teams that I'm on, because I'm working on a couple of games right now on a couple of different teams. And if they say something, I could be like, guys, this is not something we want to do. I've seen this done before. I've heard about this being done before. this is going to kill our project. We should not do this. Or yeah. I could be like, oh, you know what? That worked for them. We should do this. Da 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 da. You know, so like, that's why I feel like any good author, your job is to like educate, entertain, and inform. And I feel like a lot of video game books just entertain and they don't inform and educate. So I feel like my books do all of those things.
To kind of, I only got one more question for you before we wrap this whole thing up.
Yeah.
Who is someone that you've been dying to interview for either the books or just in some other professional capacity, but you haven't been able to get to interview yet?
I've done a lot of like really cool, like bucket list, like interviews in my life. It's like, I've interviewed like Channing Tatum. I've interviewed Philip Seymour Hoffman. I interviewed Ultimate Warrior.
Damn.
Interviewed Diamond okay. Dallas Page. Like wrestlers that I liked, you know, singers that I liked. Like I interviewed Don Felder, who wrote Hotel California.
Okay.
I've interviewed like some crazy, crazy people. People like on my bucket list that I haven't interviewed yet. I'd love to interview Billy Joel one day.
Billy Joel would be awesome. Oh my God, that'd be great.
James Hetfield would be awesome. You read the first book, you read most of it. Like Mark Turmel, getting a chance to talk to him was cool. John Tobias was cool. I would love, like, I had a long conversation with Nintendo when I was doing the first book, and I was telling them what I was doing, and I told them that I wanted to get like one of the founding fathers of Game Freak of the Pokemon series. And their response was, they gave me like a 30-35 page document with basically everything that you could have ever wanted to know about Pokemon. And it was great. It was a great document. But I told them, I was like, guys, this isn't going to work unless I can speak to somebody. I'm like, at the very least, I would need them for like an hour just to sit down with me for an hour and just answer my questions and sign a release. And we're good to go. And they were like, yeah, we can't do that. So, that kind of like,
it sounds like Nintendo.
It sounds like Nintendo. It really pissed me off.
Yeah.
And I basically said to myself, I was like, I'm going to get a Nintendo game in one of my books one day. Like I'm going to get like one of the big Nintendo games in my book. So like the Minds Behind the Adventure games, I definitely tried to get like, you know, an adventure game for Nintendo. And I, again, these are all older Japanese developers and they're still in the company. So for the Minds Behind the Shooter games, I ended up getting somebody that worked at Retro that worked on Metroid Prime. And he gave me some amazing answers about like what Retro, because Retro was a third party developer that Nintendo contracted to do Metroid Prime, and now they're a first-party developer, and they've done, like, Donkey Kong, Tropical Freeze, and now they're doing Mario Kart and stuff, so they're a first-party developer. You know, they're, like, Bungie.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, you know, Microsoft and stuff like that, or, like, Rare and Microsoft. And so, to be able to get that in the book, that was, like, a huge bucket list, like, moment. But, like, yeah, one day, I will definitely, like, I would love to get, like, the creator of, like, Castlevania or somebody from, like, the Kingdom Hearts series or something like that, or, like, Legend of Zelda. I got some big stuff in the pipeline for the Genesis book. Luckily, I have a much better relationship with Sega than I do with Nintendo. And I have a good relationship with Nintendo. They know who I am. I'm on, like, backs of boxes. They've put me on ad campaigns, like reviews and stuff that I've written before. It's just they're not used to the stuff that I'm doing yet, you know. And there's not a lot of people out there doing what I'm doing yet, which is good too for me. But yeah, to answer your question, it's just like I would love to get more like first party content. Like I would love to. Sony has been the best with me. Like when I told them that I wanted to do Parappa the Rapper, they got me like the highest resolution, like box art, the best screenshots. They helped get me like any information, sales numbers that I needed and stuff like that. And I just hope that like moving forward that like every other like big mega publisher that I work with, Activision was great with me. Like Call of Duty Modern Warfare, the one that just came out, that's featured in the Minds Behind the Shooter games. So like for them to even like want to talk, they were talking to me as the game was still in development. Like I told them, guys, I know the game hasn't been reviewed yet. I know we're not going to know like what the legacy of the game is like quite yet, but I still want to interview you and I still want to get you in the book, because as soon as somebody sees Call of Duty in a shooter book, it gives it instant legitimacy, you know? And they were like, yeah. Okay. And they were super cool with it. So I've come a long way. So like, yeah, Billy Joel, James Hetfield. And then if I can get a Pokemon game in one of these books one day, man, oh, that would be nuts. That would be nuts. Or Zelda, or like Altered Beast, yeah. Or Phantasy Star, like something really cool and different. That would be awesome. Those are like my bucket list kind of things.
And I would assume that there's a little bit of a barrier with getting to interview a Japanese developer just because of the language barrier. You have to probably get a translator, right?
Yeah, I have a translator. Correct. I have a couple of sources that are amazing that have really helped me, like in my pitch process, pitch to Japanese developers. And I have in the first book, I have the guy that did the Fireman in there, and he's Japanese. And then the creator of Wonder Boy and Monster World, Nishisawa-san, he's in there. So like, they get it. It's just they're in Japan, like LinkedIn and like Facebook aren't like they're not like how they are in America and in North America. You know, it's getting a hold of some of these guys is so much harder than getting control over, you know, getting access to like a North American developer. So like some of these guys, like a lot of the Atari guys that were around in like the 80s and the Atari and the arcade, they're all in mobile gaming now. Like they work on like mobile games. So if you search them up on LinkedIn, you'll find out that they're working for like the people that do Candy Crush and this place and that place, and they're still in games. They're just doing games differently. And when you approach them and you're like, oh, I want to talk about this game, they go, holy shit, all right, let's do it. But some of these Japanese developers, they just like kind of totally disappeared off the face of the earth. So like the only reason why I was able to get some of these Japanese developers is one, I'm really good at using the internet to find what I want. And then two, like with Wonder Boy and Monster World, they were in the middle of like two different like remakes of that game, you know, like you have the Dragon's Trap one, and then you have Monster Boy, which is awesome too. So like both of those remakes or like revisionings were being done at the same time, and I knew those dev teams, so I interviewed those dev teams, and then I was like, oh, can I get Nishisawa-san too? And they were like, sure. So it worked out for everybody. But yeah, you're right, it's like getting Japanese developers is super hard. And then, you know, it's super hard too when you're some, you know, cowboy from Brooklyn, New York, you know, and you're pitching people and they're kind of like, all right, so why do you want it? Like, people are very protective at first, but like I said, it's gotten a lot easier now that I have like a whole bunch of books out. So
yeah,
moving forward. I hope it continues to get easier, and I could put together books that people want to read. I mean, that's like the reason why I have the Facebook page for the book series, is like sometimes I'll just go up on there and I'll be like, all right guys, I'm working on the minds behind the Sega Genesis games. What games would you like to be in the book? And somebody responded a couple months ago. They're like General Chaos, Lion King, Aladdin, Jungle Strike, Road Rash 2. All those games are going to be in the Genesis book. You know, it's because those people were like, this is what we want to read. So it's like, I don't want to write books just for the sake of writing books. I want to write books for people to read and for people to get something out of. So because of that, like my bucket list changes too. Like if all of a sudden, like if nobody wanted to read a Billy Joel interview or a James Hetfield interview or a Pokemon interview, I'm going to stop trying to get those, you know, as much as I want to do them. Just because I want to read, I would want to read it, doesn't mean that somebody else is going to want to read it either, you know? So it's hard.
Yeah. But all right. Well, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up this episode. Is there anything, I mean, obviously you want to promote your upcoming books, you know, the minds behind adventure games, the minds behind sports games. Which one's coming out first? I know you mentioned it earlier in the episode. I just can't remember which one.
No, it's okay. It's a lot. Order. It's a lot. Like even my wife is like, how many books do you have coming out? I'm like, yeah, it's a lot. So the minds behind the games came out in April of 2018. Then the minds behind adventure games came out in December of 2019, a couple of months ago. The minds behind the sports games is available for pre-order right now, and that's coming out in like June or July. Then the Minds Behind Shooter Games is finished, and that's coming out in like December or January of December of 2020 or January of 2021, around that time. And then I'm currently working on the Minds Behind the Sega Genesis games. So I don't know when that's going to come out, but I'm probably like another like 5 or 6 months away from finishing that one. So by 2022, I should have 5 books out. So not bad. Not bad from starting like this whole journey in October of 2016. So it's kind of like a book a year. So it's pretty crazy. And those books are available, like the Minds Behind the Games and the Minds Behind Adventure Games are available wherever fine books are sold online. Also, if you go to patrickhickeyjr.com/books, you can order any of the books online and I will personalize it. I'll put some cool stuff in your book. I'll sign it. Like, that's like, if you really want to support like my vision and my journey, that's probably like the best place to do it, because I get to like personalize the book and make it something special for you. And it's a really cool way for us to interact. And I'll try and create like an experience for you. I've been to tons of book signings, and it's kind of like the person signs your book and then they send you like on your way. And I hate that.
Yeah.
I never want like a reader to feel like I don't want to have a conversation with them or I don't care. So I always try and make it as intimate and comfortable a process for them as possible. So if you buy the book through me, that way we'll connect. I'm super friendly on Instagram. That's my full name, Patrick Hickey Jr. I'm posting on Instagram all the time. I love Instagram. I'm on Facebook under my name. You could search me. You could friend me. I have a Facebook page, The Minds Behind the Games, and that's great because we have a ton of developers on there, and I'm constantly throwing up like stupid questions, like, you know, oh, what's the worst box art on the, you know, the Neo Geo Pocket or something like that, like geeky.
Yeah, yeah.
Geeky questions just for people to have fun. And that's the whole thing. I want to create an experience. So like, I kind of trashed Pat Contry before a bit, but like, Pat is excellent at having a community care about the things that he does, you know, and having people that interact with him and stuff like that. And that's part of like the things that I want to do on social media. That's why I take so many pictures of my collection and my family and things like that, because I want people to see that I'm more than just like a geek. I'm just like them. Like, you know, 5-6 years ago, I was just a college professor that was running a site and interviewing people and stuff. And I've just, like, you were saying before that you, at one point, you had no like way of connecting with any of these people, no way of knowing more than like what you knew. And to be honest, I was in the same exact situation. And then just one day I just decided to start emailing developers, and then my entire life changed because of that. So like, that's the only difference between me and my readers, is I've sent out a ton of emails and I've spoken to a lot of people that they don't have access to, but deep down we're bonded by the same thing, that we love games and we love this art form. So that's it, you know?
Yeah, and I will say this to all the listeners out there. I did buy a book directly off of you, Pat, directly off of him, and he does personalize it. He sent me a bunch of fucking cool. I don't know why I dropped the F-bomb there. he sent me a bunch of cool hockey cards and personalized, because I'm a Flyers fan. Mentioned the Broad Street Bullies, which is always a plus with me. But and also. I can attest your Instagram is very entertaining. You post a lot, so I always see a lot of stuff. I do miss your daily Dunkin' runs that you would always post.
Oh yeah, me too. Yeah,
I believe it. Yes. Oh my goodness. But yeah, so seriously, Pat, thank you again for. Do you prefer Pat or Patrick? What do you prefer?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. As long as there's a junior at the end, then I'm fine. So
okay.
Yeah. Like, I get Pat Hickey. I get Patrick Hickey Jr. As long as the junior is there, then I'm fine. It doesn't matter.
But thank you for joining me on this episode of Still Loading.
Yeah, no problem, man. A pleasure.
And that was my interview with Patrick Hickey Jr. I cannot thank him enough for coming onto the podcast. It was a pleasure to talk to him, and it was just awesome to get to speak to someone who is like-minded with their passion for video game history and just diving into everything about it. So it was great to have him on, and I hope to have him on again. As usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. You can also reach out to me, StillLoadingContact@gmail.com, or check out my website, StillLoadingPodcast.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a couple of different ways. The easiest way for all of you, just give it a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. Those do help to spread the show and help the show appear in search algorithms. You can also support the show by checking out my Patreon, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just a dollar a month will help me grow the show more. And then probably the most important thing, well, before I get to the most important thing, also check out the network I'm a part of, podbeardnetwork.com. And now for the most important thing, I am partnered with the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. You can check out their website, bitbybitfoundation.org, and consider donating. And that should do it all for me for this week. Seriously, thank you all once again for listening. I got a bunch of episodes coming up. I already have a bunch of the summer PS2 recorded, and I'm excited to share it all with you. So until then, I will see you all next time.